The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. We've got a great show for you today. Today we're going to be doing a rebroadcast of Choose Yiddish, a very scholarly work on the subject of the Yiddish language with Professors Laura Pressman and Hannah Rabinowitz. We have a wonderful assortment of Jewish music for your listening pleasure. This week is the portion of Ki Savo in the book of Deuteronomy. And we'll be doing some little insights into that. Maybe we'll even try to connect it to Elul, which is the kings in the field, which is what that song was about. It's a glorious day indeed here in the greater Detroit area. We are closing up with a wonderful Hasidic story. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. An Israeli military court indicted the leader of the terrorist cell that kidnapped and murdered the three Israeli teenagers in June. Hassam Kawasmi of Hebron said that the funding for the attack came from Hamas in Gaza. The IDF returned fire at a Syrian army position along the northern border after mortar shells struck Israel. Sirens were heard throughout the Golan earlier as mortar shells struck an open field. No damage or injuries were reported. The Palestinian Authority announced that it would cost $8.9 billion to rebuild Gaza after Operation Defensive Edge. The rebuilding would depend heavily on foreign aid and Israel opening its border crossings. Ukrainian Jewish businessman George Zilberbord and his guard were killed during an armed attack in Donetsk, Ukraine. Zilberbord was shot by militants who were looting homes in the victim's neighborhood. Israel's fourth Dolphin submarine is en route from a route, however you'd say it, is en route from Germany and is expected to arrive on Wednesday. The submarine is able to go down deeper and for longer periods of time. The submarine, which can carry nuclear warheads, will be named INS Tanin, Hebrew for alligator. Jordan signed some good news. Jordan signed an agreement to buy Israeli national gas for the next 15 years. The deal is worth $15 billion. Germany is establishing a $250 million fund for child survivors of the Holocaust. The fund will provide one-time payments of 2,500 euros, it's about $3,300, to Jews born in 1928 or later who spent at least 6 months in Nazi concentration camps, ghettos, in hiding, or living under false identity during World War II. So how does that make them children of survivors? That sounds like they're survivors. But anyway, for the first time, France is the country with the highest numbers of immigrants to Israel. 4,566 Jews from France made aliyah to Israel this year so far. Ukraine is second at 3,252. Russia is third at 2,632. And the U.S. is at 2,213. I've always maintained that Europe should be Judenfree. Judenrein. 6,000 people are expected to leave France for Israel in the year 2014, approximately 1% of the Jewish population. And finally, a little bit of divine providence. Russia increased its fruit and vegetable imports from Israel after the EU began a boycott of selling produce to Israel. To Russia. This comes as buyers in some European nations are refusing to buy Israeli produce since Operation Protective Edge. So the EU is not buying from Israel, and the EU is not selling to Russia. So this sounds like the transitive property. So Israel is selling to Russia. Most recently, a buyer from a supermarket chain in Montreal, I wish I knew which supermarket chain that was, announced that it would not be buying fruit from Israel. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start. Why go anywhere else when you could go to One Stop Kosher? Located on Greenfield Road, just south of 696, you're never far from One Stop Kosher. At One Stop Kosher, you'll find the largest selection of kosher wines in Michigan. One Stop Kosher has the freshest produce, the best dairy, deli, and meats, their gourmet. They even have a kosher bakery right on the premise. It's One Stop Kosher on Greenfield Road in 696 for all your shopping needs. Herschel Finman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. I am online with Lara Rabinovich and Hannah Pressman. We're talking about Choosing Yiddish, New Frontiers of Language and Culture. How are you both?
Great. Well, Thanks for having us on your show.
Good to hear. That's always good. I like doing two people. That way I get to juggle them both before. Okay, so the reason I came across this book, I wouldn't call it accidental. It was sort of like I went looking for it. Because I'm working at Wayne State University and made a proposal to the language department and to the Judaic Studies department that it's about time that Wayne State University has a course in Yiddish. And they said, well, put one together, you know, what kind of textbooks are there? What's it? So I went to the Wayne State, there I'm in Wayne State, and I'm in their server, and I typed in the word Yiddish textbooks, and lo and behold, published by Wayne State University, which neither one of you went to, is Choosing Yiddish, New Frontiers of Language and Culture. So that's how I got to come to your book. And I said, this is great. As I got it, and I looked through it, and I said, this is great, and we have to talk about this on the radio show, which is another thing that I do. So, Lara, tell us about, like, a little of the history behind what compelled you, if you were felt compelled, to writing Choosing Yiddish.
Well, I'll say first off that your story kind of encapsulates one of the reasons that we ended up putting together this edited volume. We noticed three of us, along with Shiri Gorin, were graduate students at New York University's Department of Hebrew and Judaic Studies. And around 2006, we organized a Yiddish Studies conference. And we thought it would be a small gathering of graduate students, just a small seminar, and we were overwhelmed with submissions, and we realized that we had tapped into something much larger, which you sort of also, I think, are realizing in that in 2013 or 14, you wanted to put together a Yiddish course at Wayne State University. I mean, everyone thought Yiddish was a dying language, and here we were in the sort of academic realm, and Yiddish studies was booming. So we ended up putting together a three-day conference. We received 100 or 200 submissions from all around the world. We got picked up by the press all over New York, including the New York Times, for this humble graduate student conference. So at the end of the conference, and it was, I think by all accounts, successful, we decided we had to, and many people told us we had to, put together a volume. In the ensuing couple of years, we realized that what we had tapped into was a part of a greater moment where young scholars, in particular the sort of emerging scholars, were looking to Yiddish studies as an innovative field within all kinds of disciplines in academia. So we sort of brought in the book's appeal to sort of capture this moment that we had sort of become a part of unwillingly or unbeknownst to us. None of us were Yiddish studies scholars per se. We were all plugged into Yiddish studies in different through our different avenues, but we realized there was a sort of a renaissance of Yiddish studies happening in the academy through all different disciplines, and we decided to put together a book that reflects that. So I think that's what we've done.
Excellent.
You know, Anna agrees with me.
Excellent. So
I think that is a great history of our book, Lara. Thank you.
Yes, indeed. So it sounds from talking to both of you beforehand that neither one of you would be, I suppose, called first language Yiddish speakers. Would that be correct?
Native speakers, you mean?
Yes.
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Because
yeah,
when
I grew up with part Ashkenazi and part Sephardic roots and heard scattered Yiddish words, you know, the typical things, punim and polkas and terms of endearment from my grandparents who hailed from a shtetl in Lithuania, but it was all in a very domestic, you know, family context, and so it was a language that was that felt familiar and comfortable when I started studying in an academic context. The summer after my first year of graduate school, I did a YIVO summer program in New York City. That was the beginning. So I had, you know, a very light basis. Really, though, learned it from scratch. It helped that I had a very strong basis in Hebrew language. My field is Hebrew literature, so I had the alphabet and that core of Hebrew words that is part of the Yiddish language, but no, definitely didn't start out as a native speaker.
Mm-hmm. So as Sephardic parents one side, as grandparents one side, Yiddish parents the other, so you basically grew up sort of like with Ladino-ish, then I guess.
Well, I actually didn't have that much Ladino in the home either. My mother didn't. She said that her grandmother and the aunties would speak Ladino when they were cooking, but it wasn't a language that they really taught so much to the younger generation. So I'm actually studying Ladino now as my one of my new Jewish languages that I'm trying to acquire. I'm studying it at the University of Washington with Professor David Dunas, who's visiting the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He's a world expert in Ladino. So it's been interesting learning that another Jewish language that has been perceived to be rare, that is experiencing its own kind of micro boom, kind of like the Yiddish boom of the early 21st century, I think. Perhaps on a smaller scale. So, but I digress.
Yeah, no, that's fine. When I also grew up with Yiddish in the background. I wish I spoke Yiddish like my mother, who was native to. She didn't learn how to speak English until she was 5 years old, even she was born in Newark. But Yiddish was always the Sprache der Rebbe gerät zu der Babi, as the kinder soll nicht verstehen. That the mm-hmm. parents and the grandparents would talk so that the kids wouldn't understand. Until one day I hear one of my aunts saying, Rednisch, das Herrschel versteht, yeah. So, because I did pick it up. So, Lara, talk about that a little bit. Why was there this reluctance among the immigrants and the first generation ones to convey such a rich cultural heritage such as the Yiddish language to our generation?
Well, first of all, it wasn't even really called Yiddish. It was called Jewish for a long time in the immigrant communities in the United States and Canada. So can you imagine coming to this country, trying to assimilate and being, you know, speaking a language called Jewish? You know, it's part of the classic immigrant story of shedding layers and making yourself anew and absorbing the language of the mainstream, which in this country is English, of course. So Yiddish is part of that classic immigrant story, or the decline of Yiddish is part of that classic immigrant story. And what's interesting about this book is that it's we're not really, even though we have chapters and authors who wrote about Yiddish, speaking Yiddish and what it, you know, the actual language as a spoken language, all of the contributors in this book, or many of the contributors in this book, are like us. They acquired a language as graduate students or at some point in their lives. I think there's very, very, very small, if at all, group that grew up speaking Yiddish or understanding Yiddish. So it's kind of also part of that immigrant, second, third, fourth generation immigrant story as well, in that classically the first generation, you know, wants to assimilate, the generation that follows or the generation that follows that wants to recapture what has been lost. So in a way, that's part of the reason that some of our contributors, including me, and I might be speaking for Anne as well, were sort of interested or piqued in Yiddish in the first place. But what I think distinguishes this book, and what I think is the reason that it's having this renaissance in the academy, is that what a lot of these scholars learned along the way is that Yiddish opens up all kinds of interesting avenues for research and exploration in the sort of nexus between different disciplines, between literature, between history, between film studies, between cultural studies, between linguistics. And that Yiddish sort of has this way, or it kind of comes up in all these different places because it was so, it was the language of the Jewish people, of millions of people, until very recently. So if you kind of tap into that culture and into that past, you are not only sort of, tapping into something that might be nostalgic or whatever, but also something that opens up a whole world and a whole people that I hope that we've tried to capture, at least in part, in this book through all the different disciplines that our book touches upon.
It's interesting that you mentioned multi-disciplines as far as the teaching of Yiddish, because my first idea in approaching someone is a person I thought would, who, if I want to teach a language course, the person I should go talk to at Wayne would be the head of the language department. And the head of the language department said, it's a really good idea, but we can't do it alone because of budget constraints. We need to get also somebody else involved. Who else do you think might be willing to pick this up? I said, well, there's the Judaic Studies department. I said, that's a good idea. So now we have the language department and the Judaic Studies department together. Mm-hmm. But they said, you're looking at a class, you'll probably get 8, 10, 12 people. It's not going to be really sexy enough for the administration to say, let's put money into this. Maybe we can get somebody else involved. So it says, okay. The history department, and this history, so we got this history teacher, history professors now on board with this whole thing, and so it's Yiddish is sort of like it's we're touching on this question that people ask me all the time about Judaism and Jewish. Is Jewish a religion, a philosophy, a people, a socio-economic group? What is what is Yiddish? Let's back up a bit. And for people maybe not familiar with this this concept, the whole development of Yiddish, and the reason why I want to say this is when I first I got thrown into Yiddish immersion, basically, because I went to a yeshiva in the third year. If you didn't know Yiddish, you didn't understand what was going on. So the first year, I went to one of the rabbis, and I said, could you give me the basic principles in Yiddish grammar? And he said, there's one rule in Yiddish grammar. And I'm quoting, if it sounds like Yiddish, it's correct. If it doesn't, it's not. So if you, I don't know if you came across such things from people who are native speakers, but if you could elaborate, please, either Hannah or Lara, as to the structure of the Yiddish language.
That would be a question for Hannah.
Okay.
Well, I mean, Yiddish has its origins in the Rhine River Valley in medieval times. And, Uriel Weinreich, I really defer to his great sociolinguistic history of the English language for anyone who, of the Yiddish language, rather, for anyone who wants to really grasp the origins of the language. But it has a very strong, what's interesting about it, which we kind of use it as a metaphor for why, for the what's exciting about Yiddish in the academy today is that Yiddish has as its core a certain corpus of language, and it has a strong influence from the Romance languages from where it started geographically, and then moved. It moved all over, and everywhere that it moved, it picked up local vocabulary, local linguistic and grammatical features. And layered them in. So it picked up Slavic components, for example, when the people speaking Yiddish moved in that direction, and so on. And it has this capacity to sort of fuse with other languages and cultures wherever it goes. And so this idea of Yiddish as on the one hand having boundaries, it was very obviously tied to the Jewish community where people spoke it, where the Yiddish agas is the expression for the Jewish street, literally, also kind of means, you know, the perspective of the Jewish community as a whole. What are the Jewish people, what were they saying on the Jewish street? What was the view of the Jewish people? So that this idea of the Jewish street as being, on one hand, bounded in you know, these physical neighborhoods where Jews lived in Europe and in Russia. On the other hand, Yiddish sort of leapt across those boundaries and enabled Jews to mix and speak with the people that they were in contact with. So it really is this kind of feature of language contact where it could absorb parts of other kinds of other languages, but at the same time maintain a distinct Jewish identity because there was a very strong Hebrew and Aramaic layer, the Loishen Kodesh layer, right, that came from the, you know, sacred canon. And so it has a very distinct identity. It's very Jewish. On the other hand, it's syncretic, and it combines with other languages and other cultures. And it's a language of many different cities and many different countries. And it's an international language. But we also, the Jewish community has a very particular association with it, a very particular, you know, love of it. It's a mama loshen. It's the most intimate and familiar language at the same time. So I think it's that sort of multivalent identity that we were so fascinated by in our studies of it, and that it kind of is a metaphor for what all of these different emerging scholars are doing too. They're recognizing that Yiddish is so special because it is so integrally tied to Jewish identity and the Jewish community on the one hand, but also has this history of hopping from place to place, from the Jewish street on out to the non-Jewish community, you know, taking language elements and idioms from other cultures, incorporating them back in. And that is, I think, what makes it such a fascinating language.
It's interesting. If you're just tuning in, our guests today are Lara Rabinovich and Hannah Pressman. We've written a book, Choosing Yiddish. We're talking about Yiddish, New Frontiers of Languages and Language and Culture, printed by Detroit's own Wayne State University Press. Let me continue on that with Heidi. The homogenization of all of these languages together, the amalgam that became Yiddish, it didn't happen in, so you mentioned that your family is on one side Sephardic. It didn't happen in the Sephardic communities. People who speak Ladino coming from Spain don't understand people who speak Ladino who came from Italy, who don't speak Ladino that came from North Africa. So why is it with Yiddish that it did work?
I mean, why could people overcome the sort of a different regional dialect?
Yes.
To a greater extent. You know, I don't know that much about the regional dialects of Ladino. As I said, I'm just starting out in my journey into the world of Judeo-Spanish, so I can't answer the comparative.
Okay, keep me posted and have me in mind when you get to that point. I would like to know.
Sure,
but
thing.
Anyway, Lara, do you speak Yiddish?
I read it much better than I speak it, to be honest.
Okay.
I, you know, really see it as an academic language, much like Latin. Although there are many native speakers of Yiddish today, especially in the religious and Orthodox communities, I really see it as an academic language, mm-hmm. So I read it, yes. I can speak it a little, and I can...
Okay, my mother took umbrage with the Yiddish word for sweater. Do you know what the Yiddish word for sweater is? Either one of you? No? It's sweder. Okay, and she said she didn't like that. And especially, I for a while was in Australia, and in Australia, they don't call a sweater a sweater. They call it a jumper. And the Yiddish word that the native speakers were speaking in Australia, when they would want, were cold and they needed to put something on, they put on a jumper. So I want to talk a little bit of this, if we can talk about this again, this fluidity, and is it still called Yiddish? I remember when I was learning Yiddish, and because Yiddish is not native to me, so I want to find out, if I'm translating something, I want to find out the Yiddish word for it. So I remember sitting in the cafeteria in school, and two guys are talking, and these are both native Yiddish American speakers. And one of them says, "Kannst du gehen zu Store for mir und kaufen a pack of cigarettes?" Which means, could you go to the store and buy a pack of cigarettes for me? And I just looked at this guy and said, "Are you speaking Yiddish?" because you had the word store, which I would say the word crumb, and you had the word cigarettes, which I would say papyrusen. So at what point does Yiddish, is it American Yiddish, or is it European Yiddish, Israeli Yiddish? You know, so I don't know which one of you would like to tackle that question.
Well, I'll just say that. Well, you know, one of our contributors in the book is Sarah Benor, and she has a chapter about how English is increasingly, you know, part of the Yiddish language, but also how increasingly Yiddish is part of English. So, you know, I think that is a fascinating study to look at if you look at our book. And she found through sociological studies, she's a linguist, she specializes in Yiddish linguistics. And she partnered with a sociologist, and they did the study where they discovered that increasingly Yiddish words are actually being incorporated into the English language.
Sure, who doesn't know what a bagel is? Of course.
I mean, but even Yiddishisms like "Do you want to eat by us?" instead of "Do you want to eat at our house?" She found something that especially American Jews are incorporating into the English language.
Is that really true?
Just English becomes, as much as Yiddish is always borrowing from other languages, Yiddish is always, as anyone in this country probably knows, being fused with chutzpah into the English language as well. So I think, you know, that is interesting. But I also think one thing sort of more recently that's happened in the Yiddish language is that Evo in the 20th century came to the fore and codified a lot of the grammar and Yiddishisms and all these things you've been talking about. So I think that would be my suggestion. And we certainly have two chapters on the origins of Evo and the Weinreich family and how that process of codification and teaching about Yiddish and teaching Yiddish in this country, beginning in Europe and then in this country, happened and continues to happen. So I think they would probably be the best people to answer some of those sort of more linguistic questions, or, you know, that would be where I would refer you to our book and to Evo.
Indeed. Could you add to that, please, Hannah Pressman?
Yes, absolutely. Just to follow up on your question, you know, who the Yiddish is it anyway? And everyone thinks that they have the authentic or correct version of Yiddish, right? So that anecdote about Sveder and, you know, feeling like that was the wrong term, that I think that's very revealing. And it reminded me of the spelling bee controversy last year. I don't know if you...
Oh, yeah, we reported about that. And I really went to town with a knadel. I said, how could you possibly codify and say the knadel has to be spelled that way when I would spell it with an I, you'd spell it with an E, you spell it with a Y?
So the aforementioned Sarah Benor had a piece on the Jewish Journal, which is available online, where she said people came to her to sort of rule, like King Solomon, which is the right spelling of knadel. You know, she's a linguist, so she should have the definitive spelling. And she found that there were, I think, about a dozen different ways legitimately that one could spell the word knadel, right? And people had these very visceral reactions to the story about the spelling bee, saying, you know, I wouldn't have spelled it that way. You know, I always spelled it, my grandmother and her recipes would write it out this way. Like, people had this very strong attachment to the language and feel that their way or their grandparents' way or their mother's way is the Yiddish way. And it's, I think, proof of the sort of emotional power of the language, that people have this, you know, even to a question of, you know, is it knadel, E-Y-E-I-D-L, you know, how do you spell it properly? That people reacted quite violently and said, no, I would never spell knadel that way. I don't know if there are many other languages in the world that would generate such responses, but I do recommend Sarah Benor's article in the Jewish Journal, The Linguist's Take on the Knadel Controversy, that really encapsulates that whole phenomenon last year with the spelling bee.
I actually took umbrage with that. They even suggested that they would use the word knadel because it's an American English spelling bee, and the word knadel is not an American English word. It was like sort of like, wait a minute, you're stealing from us. I felt personally violated by it. Anyway,
in a bowl of chicken soup.
Yeah, indeed. That's where knadel belongs. The knadel is a matzo ball for those people who don't speak Yiddish, and it belongs in a in a bowl of soup. One of the things that caught me about the book is on the title, I think on the cover, which I think it's a terrific cover. It's called Choosing Yiddish. And if, by the way, if you're just choosing, and we're speaking with the authors of Choosing Yiddish, Larry Rabinovich and Hannah Pressman, it's somebody standing at an ATM and they have a chance of choosing English Espanol, which is written with a little nya over the N, Yiddish, which is written in Yiddish, and I'm assuming that's Chinese, the last one, since I don't read Chinese, and it says Chinese and Chinese. I always spelled Yiddish with an aleph at the front. I know this is very anal, but and you spell Yiddish with a yud at the front, so yours is more Yiddish, and mine is more Yiddish. So talking about spelling bees, is there a spelling controversy on how to actually spell the word Yiddish?
We went with the YIVO spelling, which is the standard Yiddish spelling today. It's by no means necessarily the only spelling, and we just went with the most common and the most, the codified Yiddish, which is YIVO Yiddish throughout the book, including the cover.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, but in YIVO, I think they spell the word Yid with an aleph at the front. No? We could go look it up, but I think it does.
Yeah.
And if it has a yid, which means a Jew, has an aleph at the front. But anyway, I'm waxing, like I say, that's really anal of me. But okay,
we chose that image though, as you know, very intentionally, and we worked with a really great artist who was a student of the cartoonist and graphic artist Harvey Pekar, and what we wanted to convey with that whole ATM image was this idea, first of all, that the generation of scholars that we're highlighting in the book are consciously, intentionally choosing Yiddish over other language options as part of their graduate work, that they are opting into the language. It wasn't necessarily something they grew up with, but they're choosing it and benefiting from it in their work because it is such a dynamic language. And then also what we wanted to convey was this idea of the sort of academic marketplace and the idea of Yiddish as a currency, as something that can be used in exchange in the marketplace of ideas, right? So we wanted to convey as well this sort of financial metaphor of what Yiddish can do in the sort of marketplace of ideas.
Mm-hmm. This will be the final question because we're actually over time, but I'm just having such a good time, and I hope you two are, and I hope all of our listeners are. Way back when people were thinking about starting a country called Israel, there was a conscientious decision to move away from Yiddish and to speak Hebrew specifically. And indeed, this country, which we call Israel, the language that they speak, the national language there, is Hebrew. And Yiddish is not, it's not even like a second language. It doesn't appear on documents. It's not anything. It's not a consideration. Most Israelis do not speak Yiddish. And now, traveling around the world, I'm not such a world traveler, but my wife is, and she's finding now that she gets around better from going from place to place, which it used to be that if you went to some place and you didn't know the language, you'd go find a Jew and you'd speak Yiddish to it. Now she's finding that if she has to go find a Jew, she has to speak Hebrew to the person. So if one of you could talk about this competition that Hebrew has in taking over or usurping, or this, maybe, is it a war yet, between what is the mother tongue of Jews, Hebrew or Yiddish?
I'm going to let Hannah answer the question, but I just want to give a shout-out to Joseph Remnant, because he's the cover artist who designed our beautiful cover and drew it. But I also just want to say, before Hannah really tackles the question, is that we have an entire rubric devoted to the language wars, the quote-unquote language wars between Hebrew and Yiddish that occurred during those early years in the founding of the state, and I think Hannah could probably better talk about that than I can, though.
Yeah. So the phenomenon that you're referring to is the Riv HaLashonot or Mechemet HaSafot. Both can be translated as the language quarrel or the language war or battle. You know, all these military metaphors for the relationship between Hebrew and Yiddish. And this is a topic that I've written about. It's kind of a huge question, so I think we can only kind of tackle the tip of the iceberg. Would you like me to speak more about the historical phenomenon of the, you know, in the early 20th century of the sort of...
No, make it modern. Like, where are we up to now in this?
Okay. And Hannah, why don't you talk a little bit about the chapters in the book? I mean, that do justice. I think that, you know, to cover this very well in the book.
Yeah, I mean, the situation in Israel is particularly interesting, I think, because there is, in fact, even though Hebrew has quote-unquote won in terms of being the language of the state of Israel officially, there is quite a Yiddish revival going on in Israel right now in terms of heritage, people embracing that heritage and learning Yiddish. I mean, the phenomenon of going back to Eastern Europe to examine Holocaust history, that's already been going on for.
Let me just interrupt. Would you say that's paralleling what's going on in America? The same type of a thing. These are like the grandchildren of the immigrants that came to Israel. The grandchildren of immigrants who came to America are trying to go back to the Yiddish.
Right. So there is now that you know the state of Israel has been established and that sort of the future of the Jewish people is a little more stable than it was, you know, in the 1930s and 40s. Now that there's that sort of sense of security, I think that people feel permission in a way to go back to the diaspora, to embrace the culture of the shtetl and Yiddish and Eastern Europe, which felt, I think, in the formative years of when Israel was being established, it felt not so permissible because there was that need to establish the sort of the collective Hebrew culture and that the identity of the state. So there is a kind of opening up and a relaxation and an embrace of that heritage that is complicated. And Ladino is part of that picture too, by the way. Ladino has been recognized now as a Jewish language in the state of Israel, and so I think that is a really fascinating piece of, you know, the 21st century picture of Yiddish is what, you know, and something to think about, you know, maybe for our next volume, right, Lara? What is going to happen to Yiddish identity when it's, you know, when it has become part of this popular resurgence in different pockets around the world, and what is going to be its identity when, on the one hand, you know, the world of the shtetl has disappeared. It exists, you know, in our nostalgia and in our imagination. But on the other hand, there are communities and individuals who are connecting with Yiddish in these really new and creative ways and sort of creating these new virtual landscapes for Yiddish communities. So I think that's something that scholars are going to have to reckon with going forward.
Terrific. Okay, that's going to do it. I could really devote the whole hour of the show to it, maybe more. But so you answered my last question. Is there going to be a son of choosing Yiddish, maybe frontiers already crossed of language and culture?
There'll be a daughter, and it'll be called Choosing Ladino.
Okay. Okay. That's going to do it. Our guests have been Lara Rabinovich and Hannah Presson, and together with Shiri Gorin, who was teaching today at this time. Choosing Yiddish, New Frontiers of Language and Culture, Wayne University Press. I felt smarter. That's the type of book that this is, and I recommend it highly. So thank you so much for coming on.
Your course. I hope your course materializes, and I hope that the book is useful.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
It's our pleasure. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Do you or someone you know have an addiction to opiates? Ready to take your life back but don't have the time for a long inpatient program? MDS Drug Detox is a team of physicians with extensive experience in the field of rapid drug detox under anesthesia. MDS is the nation's only rapid opiate detox under anesthesia facility with the same doctors, RNs, and certified paramedics attending the entire drug detox process. MDS Drug Detox is safe and effective. Their goal is to provide the best, the safest, and the most economical way to free you from your addiction. MDS uses the highest standards of care and the best FDA-approved medications. MDS Drug Detox understands what your concerns are. Make the call today, 888-637-6968, or go online to www.mdsdrugdetox.com. That's 888-637-6968, MDS Drug Detox. Herschel Fenman here. You are listening to The Jewish Hour. That was an amazing interview. It's just like informative, educational. That's, you know, entertaining. That's what we're here for. We have up now for your entertainment, brand new. This is Gad Elbaz, A Mother's Dream. He wrote this after the Operation Defensive Edge. In memory, I think maybe he lost a friend or something like that, or some relative of his, or a friend of his lost a son, something to that degree. It's called A Mother's Dream. Quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Some things are better the way they used to be, like the crisp feel of a cool autumn day, the serenity of a baby sleeping, or the feeling of coming home after a long trip. Franklin Cider Mills makes cider the way cider is supposed to be. Its old-fashioned, clear, crisp taste reminds you of a cool autumn day. Located in the heart of historic Franklin Village at 14 Mile and Franklin Road, Franklin Cider Mill has been making cider the same way for over a century. Always fresh, with no additives or preservatives. You just can't buy Franklin Cider in any supermarket. Franklin Cider Mill is open from Labor Day weekend to after Thanksgiving from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. Come visit Franklin Cider Mill. It's kind of like coming home.
Hey, Herschel Finman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. Yeah, today's such a beautiful day. Might be just a day to go over to downtown Franklin. You can pick yourself up a quart, a gallon of Franklin cider. The cider is kosher. Tell them you heard it on the Jewish Hour. Rabbi Finman sent you. They'll appreciate that little shout out. Speaking of shout outs, today, this afternoon, if you really got something to do, here you go. Step into art at the J. Get ready to color your world with art, music, and fun. Enjoy a free concert, family concert by the Motor City Brass Band, a beautiful mosaic project for your children, and celebrate the DIA's Inside-Outside program as we view fabulous reproductions from the museum's collection. That's today. 1 o'clock is the concert. 2 o'clock is the art project at the Jewish Community Center in Oak Park. And children, the first 50 children get to do the art project. It's $3 a kid for the children. The concert is free. And at this point, I say, well, if you want to call somebody, it's 967-4030 for any more information. But just go over and have yourself a party at the JCC today, 1 o'clock. Should be a real hoot. Does your organization having a thing? Well, send it to me at rabbifinman.com. And we will announce it free of charge because that's what we do. Coming up next, we are within a month of Yom Kippur, and it says that you have to get ready a month before the holiday for the holiday. So here, for your listening pleasure, is a rendition of Kol Nidre, which is considered one of the most solemn, respectful prayers, the beginning of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And this rendition is done by Yitzchak Perlman on violin, and cantor Yitzchak Meir Halfgut singing Kol Nidre is just for you. Thank you.
Art Studio of Oak Park is now accepting students. Whether you're a real beginner or have been at it for a lifetime, the Art Studio of Oak Park has something for you. All levels welcome, all ages welcome. Private tutoring or small friendly classes. Flexible hours available. The Art Studio of Oak Park is very affordable. Make your life better. Put art into your life. The Art Studio of Oak Park offers lessons in a strictly kosher environment. Call today, 248-542-5087. That's 248-542-5087. It's great having an art room right in the neighborhood.
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Why go anywhere else when you could go to One Stop Kosher? Located on Greenfield Road, just south of 696, you're never far from One Stop Kosher. At One Stop Kosher, you'll find the largest selection of kosher wines in Michigan. One Stop Kosher has the freshest produce, the best dairy, deli, and meats, their gourmet. They even have a kosher bakery right on the premise. It's One Stop Kosher on Greenfield Road in 696 for all your shopping needs. Herschel Finman here. You're listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? The easiest, bestest way, I would say, go to rabbifinman.com. That's www.rabbifinman.com. You'll find archived editions of the show. You'll find archived editions of the E-Parsha, U-Parsha, and Hasidic U-Story, different media of yours truly conveying Judaism and ideals of Judaism in an interesting and hopefully entertaining way. You'll find the classes page, which yours truly have given over the course since 2009. I've been giving a class, and every week I post that one specific class. I do lots of classes, but this one is postable, and you can listen to it. And it's my personal opinion, it's quite good. And you'll find the very important donations page. We're still looking to pay off August. We're looking to pay off September. Rosh Hashanah is coming up. You have to check and see, well, how much have you given this year? Are you up with your tithes? Are you keeping up with your charitable giving? Have you given lately? Have you ever given to the Jewish Hour? If you've never given to the Jewish Hour and you're a regular listener, it's about time. Go give something to the Jewish Hour. Do that by going to rabbifinman.com, click on the donations page. It's all free, safe, and the donations are free. You don't have to pay for the donations. You just have to give the donations. And it's secure through PayPal, and it'll do your job for you. And you'll be happy you did, as the Jewish Hour now in its 18th year, its 19th year, we'll be able to continue. We know we're doing it month to month to month, and we are a month behind in this month's month. But, you know, we know we're going to catch up, and God willing, we'll be paid up for the following. By October, we hope to pay off August and September. That's our goal. We don't have goals of paying off like the next year or the next 10 years or whatever that. We want to pay off the month, and we don't want to be going into the next year before the month is. So just an insight into the Parsha. We've only got like a minute and a half left. The interview was quite long. This portion of the week is a portion of Kisavo. It is always read 2 weeks before Rosh Hashanah. People say that the reason why it's read 2 weeks before Rosh Hashanah is because most of the portion, I'd say three-quarters of the portion, are the curses which are promised to the Jewish people if they don't listen to God. But that's not why the portion is called Kisavo. The portion that's called Kisavo is because when you come into the land, Kisavo means when you'll come into the land, you'll have to give first fruits. because we know that in preparation for Rosh Hashanah, 2 weeks before Rosh Hashanah, we know we have to be considerate. We are considered, and we should consider ourselves as God's first fruits. Why is it that in this portion specifically is the Techacha, the rebuke, the 98 curses? Is because being that we are the first, God expects more of us. That's going to do it for us. We hope we had a chance to educate you a bit. We hope we had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope you have a great week. We hope to see you again back next week. Take care.